This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we go to the Rio Plus 20 Summit, where we will be joined live by the former Bolivian ambassador to the United Nations, discussing what can be done with the environment and the economy. We also follow up on the case of Julian Assange, still housed in the Embassy of Ecuador in London. We'll be speaking live with former CIA officer Ray McGovern. And we'll hear Julian Assange's conversation with the president of Ecuador in regard to what now is the question of whether he will be granted political asylum. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're joined live by Pablo Salón, the former ambassador to the United Nations from Bolivia, where in Rio there are some 50,000 people or more engaged in still more discussions about what to do about the environment and the economy. What is your reading of the summit?
Well, here in Rio de Janeiro, we are having two summits. One side, we have the official summit, where around 83 heads of state have come, not the president of the U.S., but there are delegations from the 193 countries that confirm the U.S. And very far from there, and in the middle of the city, there is the People's Summit that has gathered a lot of grassroots organizations and social movements around the world. So there are two meetings. The meeting of the government has already agreed a document that's called The Future We Want. Immediately the People's Summit has reacted saying that that is not the future we want. And it is absolutely making a lot of protests against this document that the government have agreed by consensus. What does this future we don't want says? It says mainly that what we need to do is to have bring and treat nature as a capital. The main analysis is that capitalism hasn't worked because nature didn't have a monetary value. And now the idea is to assign a monetary value to the functions and services of the ecosystems and bring them into the market. That under the name of green economy. And this is seen by the People's Summit as a new stage in the process of commodification and privatization of nature. That is why both visions are confronted very strongly here. If you see the official document, The Future We Don't Want, it has the word growth, economic growth, several times, around 23 times. But the word redistribution doesn't appear at all. And we are discussing this in a world where 1% of the population concentrates 50% of the wealth that is produced by the humanity in the planet. So two approaches, very different. One that says we need to grow but try to make less damage. And in order to do that, let's put a value and bring into the market those services that the nature provides. And on the other hand, the People's Summit saying, no, the key thing is not to grow forever. In reality, it's not sustainable development. It's sustainable redistribution. And what we need to do is to recognize the limits of our planet and to try to live without affecting more the vital cycles of nature. And that is what it's called, to respect the rights of nature.
Your Excellency, President Morales of Bolivia, of course, says that commercializing natural resources is a form of colonizing southern countries. And Cuban President Raul Castro says that the flaw of this Rio Plus 20 meeting is that it does not address the cleanup of nature as a result of rampant industrialism and exploitation of resources. And you yourself take yet another approach in your piece at the crossroads between the green economy and the rights of nature. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah, we all agree. There is an agreement between the two summits that are taking place here that there is an ecological crisis. So we have an understanding that we must do something, and really fast, in order to bring balance again to our planet Earth, because that balance is seriously damaged. Now, how you're going to do it? By bringing market rules over the laws of nature? Does nature have laws? For example, can you do whatever you want and affect the vital cycle of water? What happens if you do it? What are going to be the consequences? We are already seeing that the cycle of carbon that is something that in the planet is has specific quantities, and during the last 600,000 years has been affected in the last 300 years. And this is causing climate change and global warming. So we have to recognize that there are limits to human activity. When we speak about that we have lost in the last 30 years around 30% of the biodiversity of the plants and animals, then we're speaking about an ecocide. So from the perspective of rights of nature, not only humans have the right to exist, but also all the other beings in our planet. And we have to recognize that humans are just one part of the ecosystem. We are not the owners of planet Earth. We are one of its elements. And as one of its elements, we have to take care of all the elements of the planet Earth. And that means to respect their intrinsic laws, their intrinsic values, the way they interrelate between them. And we cannot try to rule them by applying market rules. Because if we apply market rules, we are going to create more deterioration of our environment, and we are going to affect seriously those vital cycles of nature. For example, if the glaciers in the Himalayas or in the Andean region begin to disappear, like it is happening right now, we are going to have a serious problem of water. Not only for humans, but for agriculture, for biodiversity, for the land itself. So this is going to have an impact that's going to be beyond imagination, and that is what scientists are already saying. I must say that here also in Rio de Janeiro are 500 scientists that are having a meeting, and all of them have come to the conclusion that time stops, that we don't have no more time, and that we have to do something in order to bring back balance to our in our planet.
Your Excellency, we hear quite a bit about the term greenwashing and the idea or the concept of carbon credits. Can you explain the intent and the fallacies in those procedures?
Yes, the issue is that, for example, what they want to do in relation to forests, they don't want to privatize and commodify this time the wood of the tree. They want to commodify and privatize the capacity of the tree, of the forest, to absorb and capture CO2. So they will measure what is the amount of CO2 that the forest can storage, and they will create carbon credits that will be bought by companies in the north that will use them as polluting permits. So if you buy one of these, you can say, well, instead of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in my industry, I have bought this carbon credit so I can keep polluting. So, of course, that will mean really a more chaotic situation in relation to our environment. So those are the kind of mechanisms that are being promoted in the official meeting of Rio Plus 20, and that is why the People's Summit says that's a new process of commodification of nature.
We're speaking with His Excellency Pablo Solon, the former Bolivian ambassador to the United Nations. He is live in Brazil for the Rio Plus 20 Summit, plus the People's Summit on the Environment. And one of the things that is troubling in regard to carbon and greenhouse gases is that perhaps at the original Earth Summit in Rio, and certainly at the Kyoto Summit, the Obama administration and the United States historically has insisted that any arrangement not count the tremendous amount of carbon pollution created by the military operations of the Pentagon. Is that still the case in the Rio Plus 20 summit, that people are looking the other way at the CO2 emissions of military transportation and armaments, explosives, and the infrastructure?
There is a very interesting case, because that you have highlighted, there are commitments of developed countries to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. But in reality, in the UNFCCC Convention of Climate Change, there is no kind of provision of the CO2 emissions that come from wars and from the military sector. And this is something very important, because in many cases, one of these wars can generate more greenhouse gas emissions than many developing countries do. So this is an issue that has been that has to be addressed. But it has to be addressed also from the other perspective. Here, the other frustration is that there is almost no money for sustainable development. So everybody speaks about sustainable development, but at the end of the day, there is no resources. And developing countries here were asking for an amount of $30 billion. And at the end, in the official document, no number has been agreed. It has not any number at all. There is a lot of concern, because while this is happening in relation to our environment, the military sector, the defense sector in developed countries has a budget of $1,500 billion. So $1.5 trillion are going to the military sector. So why is it that there is no funds at all here in Rio to reestablish our balance with nature, our harmony with nature, while there is such a huge amount of money for the military sector defense, this is coming from the public sector, so all citizens, especially of developed countries, are paying through their taxes to have this military apparatus, but the money of the society is not being spent as it should be to reestablish the balance with our environment.
The Pentagon is, of course, the number one producer of CO2, carbon dioxide emissions, on the entire planet. And Pablo, one other thing here. We're now in a situation with the constant nuclear pollution of the Pacific Ocean following the monstrous disaster at Fukushima. There are rearrangements of nuclear plans taking place in some European countries. President Barack Obama is saying that that he wants to continue with the nuclear program because, in his words, it is a clean energy source. And has the subject of nuclear energy power generation come up in regard to the balance in regard to the safety of the environment?
Well, here in the People's Summit, there is a lot of concern about new nuclear plants and existing nuclear plants. There is a tent only to address the issue of nuclear energy. And I would say that there is an absolute consensus that we should not promote more nuclear plants because there are many reasons. One reason is that whatever you do, the waste that comes from nuclear plants will remain for more than 100 years. Another issue is that any kind of accident that you can have in a nuclear plant, as we have seen in the case of Fukushima or Chernobyl, if it's caused by natural disasters or by a human mistake, will have a serious impact. And you're seeing that the time, it will take several decades to clean up the mess when a problem emerges from a nuclear plant. The other key issue is that even if we don't take into account this serious problem, to build a nuclear plant takes 15 to 20 years. So in reality, that's not going to be a solution for what we are facing now. It's going to be only a business for the companies that are going to build that. So instead of going for solutions that can really bring renewable energy now and save renewable energy with the full participation of the society, we are going to this nuclear energy. But I may say that most of the governments in different countries are moving against the development of more nuclear plants. This is the case of Brazil. Brazil 2 years ago was going to develop I don't know how many nuclear plants, but now they have announced that they are not going to develop more nuclear plants by the moment.
Thank you for the insight and reporting from the scene. We've been speaking with His Excellency Pablo Solon, the former Bolivian ambassador to the United Nations. He is also the author of At the Crossroads Between Green Economy and the Rights of Nature. That's available at the website climateandcapitalism.com. And additional work of Mr. Solon is available at focusweb.org. And thank you for being on 5 o'clock Shadow today.
Thank you very much.
You are attuned to Pacifica Radio. This is 5 o'clock Shadow, originating at WBAI. And here's more from the United Nations, where the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon had this comment on the Rio Plus 20 summit.
For too long, we have behaved as though we could indefinitely burn and consume our way to prosperity. Today, we recognize that we can no longer do so. We recognize that the old model for economic development and social advancement is broken. Rio Plus 20 has given us a unique chance to set it right, to create a new model, to set a new course that truly balances the imperatives of robust growth and economic development with the social and environmental dimensions of sustainable prosperity and human well-being.
That was United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the subject of the Rio Plus 20 summit now taking place in Brazil, and there will be an undebated resolution that will be enacted at the end of this week. And we turn now to the case of Julian Assange. We follow up with our conversation with his attorney, Michael Ratner, in our previous edition of the program, and continue to keep our eyes on the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Julian Assange remains at this date. He is seeking political asylum and fighting extradition to Sweden. Ray McGovern has been long working with the Assange team and the WikiLeaks team and many other organizations, including his former officership in the Central Intelligence Agency, where he was an analytic officer. And he most recently has published on Consortium News the overnight article titled Julian Assange's Artful Dodge, which begins saying, barring a CIA drone strike on the Ecuadorian embassy in London, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's sudden appeal for asylum there may spare him a prison stay in Sweden or possibly the United States. Assange's freedom now depends largely on Ecuadorian President Rafael Vicente Correa Delgado, a new breed of independent-minded leader like Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. And welcome back to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Ray.
Thank you, Robert. Good to be with you.
Well, what do you think are the prospects for the release of Julian Assange into arms other than the British bobbies who are after him for violating parole?
Well, you know, the editor who put that title on my item there, Artful Dodge, that's exactly what it is. Julian Assange was up against it. He was just on the verge of being extradited to Iceland on charges that almost everyone believes were trumped up. No matter of fact, I correct myself. There were no charges. They didn't even have the kind of evidence that would allow them to trump up charges. That's how bad it was. And yet, without any formal charges from Sweden, he was the High Court in London succumbed to U.S. pressure to have him extradited, and that was going to happen in another 2 weeks. So he made this artful dodge into the Ecuadorian embassy, and that leaves two questions, okay? The first question is, what kind of fellow is the president of Ecuador? Now, we have a new breed, as you mentioned before. Correa is educated at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium, where they teach things like liberation theology, you know, like give the underdog a break. And if Assange is anything but an underdog, I just don't know what it is. Besides that, Ecuador has a record for almost 2 years of proposing to give succor, to give some asylum to Assange. So it was kind of a no-brainer that that Assange would interview Correa exactly 4 weeks ago on Assange's TV program on RT, and they got along so well together, I'm sure that there was an agreement that if in extremis, if Assange had to go into the Ecuadorian embassy, that he would be given at least a safe place to stay. Now, big question here is, what is Correa going to do? He also studied not only at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium, but at the University of Illinois Urbana. 4 years there, master's degree and PhD in economics. My roommate on the U.S. boat to Gaza exactly 1 year ago, Robert Naiman, who is out there in Urbana, knew Correa and describes him as a fellow who was part of the teachers' union, a very, very progressive fellow who, given his druthers, will almost certainly agree to give Assange the kind of political asylum that he is due. Now, will he do the right thing? Well, the Washington Post today, taking its orders from the U.S. government, warns in a major editorial, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, about eight paragraphs, okay? It says, aha, remember, a full third of Ecuador's foreign sales, $10 billion in 2011, they go to the United States, supporting 400,000 jobs. Now, these preferences come up for renewal by Congress early next year if Correa, President Correa, seeks to appoint himself America's chief Latin American enemy and give Julian Assange protection between now and then. It's not hard to see what the outcome will be. Well, you know, usually you have diplomats saying those things in private. Here is the Washington Post unashamedly warning Correa that he could face economic catastrophe. Now, I've had time to check with Robert Neiman out there, alumnus of the University of Illinois Urbana, and he tells me that, you know, Ecuador would really not be too hurt no matter what the U.S. did. It's not clear what the threat would be since Chevron and others are already trying to block the renewal of the trade preferences because of what Correa has done to Chevron. And some people in Ecuador would probably be of the view that renewing the preferences was a lost cause anyway. So this may be a hollow threat. Bottom line here, I think, and I'm strengthened by my friend Robert Neiman, that if Correa has his druthers, and it seems like he does in Ecuador, that he'll grant asylum to Julian Assange, as he should.
We're speaking with Ray McGovern, and Ray, you raise a prospect of some delicious speculation in that the ankle bracelet, the GPS tracking, the surveillance teams of the United Kingdom that were presumably on the case of Julian Assange, following monitoring, bed checking, and such like that, somehow he slipped out of the ankle bracelet and into the embassy. Now, we know that Julian Assange is a very technically adept person, but do you think this occurred because Julian Assange is a great hacker or because the British authorities were something of a slacker?
Well, Scotland Yard, in this case, was either grossly negligent or wanted this to happen. Let's face it. The British, including all the jurists and judges, maybe not all, but most of them, are holding their nose, you know, at the stench that comes from the High Court bowing to U.S. pressure to extradite Julian Assange when Sweden hasn't even leveled any formal charges against him. I mean, it's transparently embarrassing for the Brits. So on the one hand, they would love to get rid of him. On the other, you know, they are incompetent. And I understand that he was allowed to walk around London. It was just at night that he had to be under house arrest. So it's equally possible that incompetence is the answer here. But I don't think so, because, as I say, the Ecuadorians had already offered him asylum in November of 2010. So one would have thought that a precaution would have been taken, given the dire circumstances, that the Ecuadorian embassy would have been covered to disallow or to bar Assange from going there. The interesting thing here is Scotland Yard and the delicate question about, let's assume Correa does the right thing and says, yes, you qualify under any international standard for political asylum, and we're going to take you back to Quito and give you a place to stay. Now what happens? Well, the question is, what do the British do? And most people tell me, and my best contact in the British Foreign Office has warned me, that, as he puts it, there's no way. There's no way that the British government will let him off and go to Ecuador. Now, that's tough, because, you know, if they want to get rid of him, and he's just a real headache there, are they going to let him languish in the Ecuadorian embassy as long as Cardinal Mincenti, who defected to the U.S. embassy in Warsaw during the Cold War, 15 years? Are they prepared to deal with that? I don't know. So there has to be some artful way for this artful dodger to get out of the embassy to the airport and back to Ecuador. And I dearly hope more imaginative minds than I are working with that.
Well, Ray, one of the suggestions that we discussed with Michael Ratner was that the Ecuadorian government adopt Julian Assange as a citizen, then appoint him a diplomat, and then he can leave under courtesy of a diplomatic immunity passport, or perhaps stuff him in a diplomatic pouch in the trunk of a limousine and fly and drive him out to the airport. But more seriously, Ray.
Well, I've looked into that, Robert. You might want to know about this. I did share this suggestion with my very knowledgeable contact, retired Foreign Service officer from London. He said, if Julian were granted Ecuadorian citizenship as opposed to asylum, that might be a way out, but he'd then have to be notified or accredited to the British government, and the British government would quite probably refuse to accept that notification. There are procedures where the Court of St. James, as they call it, can refuse ambassadors or heads of mission, and there's probably, my friend thinks that they would probably reject any artifice like this. Now, that's just one opinion. And if the British really want to get this fellow off their hands and get rid of this headache, then maybe they would grant him. So that's an imaginative possibility. I hope people are playing with it, and I hope something like that will work.
Well, Ray, more seriously, there have been calls for the assassination of Julian Assange, and some woman who ran for vice president some time ago, a former governor of a northern state, said that Julian Assange is an anti-American operative with blood on his hands.
Right.
And we have a situation now in which the president has formally arrogated to himself the decision-making ability to assassinate what are termed as operatives against the interests of the United States. And I think we must discuss this to see if Julian Assange might be under any jeopardy beyond the legal ones that he is facing.
Well, the legal ones, as you described them, are clear. It's not only Sarah Palin, but the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, who said back on December 7th, 2010, that Assange should be, quote, vigorously prosecuted for espionage. I mean, not just prosecuted, but vigorously prosecuted for espionage, violating the Espionage Act, U.S. of 1917. He claims, Dianne Feinstein says, he claims to be a journalist, but you know what? He's an agitator intent on damaging our government. So First Amendment, out the window. We've seen, as you just mentioned, the Fifth Amendment, which guarantees all persons the right not to lose life, liberty, or property without due process. We've seen that out the window with President Obama arrogating to himself the possibility or the authority to assassinate people by drone strike, even U.S. citizens. So put yourself in Assange's position. He had no way out. It's not the ideal situation for him now, but at least he's not going to languish in a Swedish prison. There's no bail in prison in Sweden, by the way, and then expect to face the likes of Sarah Palin and Dianne Feinstein and the tender mercies of U.S. justice, on the other hand. So that's one thing. The other thing, and I think what you may be driving at here, is what could happen to Assange before he got out of Britain? Well, you know, the British pretend to be very nice diplomatically and observe all the customs, but there's one custom they're very good at, and that is, eliminating people with extreme prejudice, is the way we used to say it in the CIA. And I'm very mindful of Dr. David Kelly, who 9 years ago publicly told the BBC that the case for war against Iraq was a crock, okay? He was a scientist. He worked in the MOD, Ministry of Defense in London, and told the BBC, look, you know, there aren't any biological weapons, much less nuclear weapons. I know because I was a UN inspector. Now, what happened to David Kelly? A week or so after he did that, he went for a walk along a river, and he, quote, committed suicide, end quote. The vein that he was alleged to have cut spilled very little blood. The autopsy was kept secret for 70 years. Give me a break. Most of my friends in Britain believe that David Kelly was done in by the likes of the plumbers in our country, by the likes of not rogue elements, but what the Russians called wet affairs people who do these kinds of things. So if that happened to Dr. David Kelly, and there's no proof of that, of course, but there is ample circumstantial evidence, what's going to happen to Assange on his way to the airport? I think they need to, find some artful way to get him out other than subject him to the tender mercies of the security forces acting not only at London's direction, but at Obama's direction. Just think of what would happen. Now, we have this, think of Obama's situation. He wants to be really tough. He's got Osama bin Laden. He killed Osama bin Laden. Yay! Most Americans say, that's great. Now, let's say something happens to Assange. Well, who's going to be president in the next election? Obama's got it sewed up. There's two for two. That's how bad it is in this country right now. No respect at all for international law or the Constitution of the United States. And that, for me, Robert, I have to tell you, is a big problem. Because when I was sworn in as an Army officer, I took a solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. That oath has no expiration date. And I am in a quandary here. I'm trying to piece together what the current situation requires of someone like me and millions of others who took that oath as we watch the President of the United States tear up our Constitution, revoke the Fifth Amendment, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, you name it, it doesn't matter anymore. What is my duty as one sworn to uphold the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic? What is my requirement right now? I'm serious about this. I don't know what it is, but I'm trying to figure it out, because one option is not an option, and that is just to sit by and watch it all happen and watch my children and grandchildren have to live in a very different country from the one that I was privileged to grow up.
Well, I thank you for bringing that focus to us today, Ray McGovern, former Army officer and officer of the Central Intelligence Agency and analyst for 30 years, presidential briefings and many other things. And most recently, the author of a piece at Consortium News called Julian Assange's Artful Dodge. Thank you so much for being with us today, Ray.
You're most welcome, Robert.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. My name is Robert Knight, and now we hear the actual words of Julian Assange himself speaking with the president of Ecuador, which nation he is now in the embassy of in London, seeking political asylum. This is from a recent program of Julian Assange, a television program called The World Tomorrow.
I'm Julian Assange.
Roger, I'll get you in the space.
Editor of WikiLeaks. We've exposed the world's secrets.
All these documents belong to the United States government.
Been attacked by the powerful.
The United States strongly condemns.
Hey, quit asking questions.
We broke the law.
Illegally shoot the son of a...
For 500 days now, I've been detained without charge. But that hasn't stopped us. Today, we're on a quest for revolutionary ideas that can change the world tomorrow. With Chavez and Lula out of the public eye, a new generation of Latin American leaders has arisen. This week, I am joined by the president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa. Correa is a left-wing populist who has changed the face of Ecuador, but unlike his predecessors, he holds a PhD in economics. According to U.S. embassy cables, Correa is the most popular president in Ecuador's democratic history. But in 2010, he was taken hostage in an attempted coup d'etat. He blames the coup attempt on corrupt media and has launched a controversial counteroffensive. Correa says the media defines what reforms are possible. I want to know, is he justified? And what is his vision for Latin America?
Is he hearing me?
I can hear you, President Correa.
Le puedo escuchar, Presidente Correa.
Hi, nice
you
to
too.
Meet you.
You too.
Sí.
Where are you, in England?
I am in England under house arrest now for 500 days.
500 days?
With no charge.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Sí.
Sí, es mejor traducir, María Luisa.
Yeah.
I like a little bit more Spanish, you know.
Oh, okay. So let's see if we can do that. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Action. What is the Ecuadorian perspective on the United States? The sort of long perspective of US involvement. I'm not asking for a caricature of the United States, but what do Ecuadorian people
think about the United States and its involvement in Latin America and in Ecuador?
Well, as Evo Morales says, the only country that can be sure never to have a coup d'etat is the United States, because it hasn't got a U.S. embassy. In any event, I'd like to say that one of the reasons that led to police discontent was the fact that we cut all the funding the U.S. Embassy provided to the police. Before, and even a year after we took office, we took a while to correct this. Before, there were whole police units, key units, fully funded by the U.S. Embassy, whose officers in command were chosen by the U.S. ambassador and paid by the U.S. And so we have increased considerably the police's pay. However, as their salaries were coming from somewhere else, they didn't even notice. We did away with all that. But there are some who still long for those times, which will never come back. Relating to the US, ours has always been a relationship based on affection and friendship. But in the framework of mutual respect and sovereignty, I lived in the U.S. for 4 years, have 2 academic degrees from there. I love and admire the American people a great deal. Believe me, the last thing I'd be is anti-American. However, I will always call a spade a spade. And if there are international U.S. policies that are detrimental to our country, or even to that of Latin America, I will denounce them strongly. And I will never, ever allow my country's sovereignty to be affected by them.
Your government closed the U.S. base at Malta. Can you tell me why you decided to close this base?
But would you accept having a foreign base set up in your country, Julian? In any case, if the matter is as simple as I once said, okay, it's not a problem to set up a U.S. base in Ecuador. We can give the go-ahead as long as we are granted permission to set up an Ecuadorian military base in Miami. If it's not an issue, they should agree. Are you having a lot of fun with the interview, Julian? I'm glad to hear that. Me too.
I am enjoying your jokes a great deal, yes. President, President Correa, why did you want us to release all the cables?
Those who don't owe anything have nothing to fear. We have nothing to hide. Your WikiLeaks have made us stronger, as the main accusations made by the American embassy were due to our excessive nationalism and defense of the sovereignty of the Ecuadorian government. Indeed, we are nationalists. Indeed, we do defend the sovereignty of our country. On the other hand, WikiLeaks wrote a lot about the goals that the national media pursue, about the power groups who seek help and report to foreign embassies. We have absolutely nothing to fear. Let them publish everything they have about the Ecuadorian government. But you will see how many things about those who oppose the civil revolution in Ecuador will come to light. Things to do with opportunism, betrayal, and being self-serving.
Subsequently, you kicked out the U.S. ambassador to Ecuador as a result of WikiLeaks' publication of cables. Why did you kick her out? It seems to me it would be easier to go, well, I have these cables from this ambassador. I know now how she thinks. Isn't it better to keep the devil you know?
She was told this, but filled with arrogance, she said she had nothing to say. She was a woman totally against our government, a woman of extreme right-wing views, who still lived in the Cold War of the 1960s. And what broke the camel's back, the last straw, was WikiLeaks, where she wrote that her own Ecuadorian contacts told her that the chief of the national police was corrupt, and that surely I had given him that post knowing he was corrupt, so that I could control him. The lady ambassador was called and asked to give an explanation, but with all her loftiness, insolence, grandeur, imperial airs she puts on, she said she had nothing to account for. And as we here respect our country, we threw her out. I'd like to say that some months ago, after almost a year of inquiry, Commander Hurtado, falsely accused in that WikiLeaks cable by the ambassador, was found not guilty of all charges. This shows once again how ill-intentioned US officials, due to their ill will towards progressive governments that are seeking change, report on anything groundless, based purely on rumors and gossip provided by their contacts, who are usually people in opposition to our government.
President
Correa, how did you find the Chinese to deal with? They are a big, powerful country. Are you swapping one devil for another in dealing with the Chinese?
First of all, we don't work with devils. If anyone comes up to us as a devil, we simply tell him, no thank you. Secondly, you can see a bit of the selling out, the snobbery, even the neo-colonialism of our elites and certain media. When 60% of our trade and the bulk of the investment were concentrated in the US, and we were left with no money to move our economy forward, there wasn't any issue. Now that we are the country where most of the Chinese investment in the region takes place, it has suddenly become an issue. Because the Chinese aren't that tall or reddish-looking, because they don't have light eyes, they are called devils. Now, enough of that. If even the United States itself is being financed by China, how wonderful it is that it funds Ecuador. It's wonderful that it provides funds for oil extraction, mining, hydroelectric power stations. We are not only getting Chinese funding, we're also attracting investment from Russia, Brazil. We have expanded our markets and our funding sources. However, there are people who were born with a yoke attached to the neck and who prefer to go on with that level of dependency. That's it.
President Correa, as you know, for many years, I have been fighting a fight for freedom of expression, for the right for people to communicate, for the right to publish true information. How is it that your reforms will not lead to the suppression of true information?
Bueno, usted una muy buena muestra, Julián, de cómo es la prensa.
Well, Julian, you are a good example of what the press is like, as well as these associations like the Inter-American Press Association, which is simply an association of newspapers in Latin America. Many books have been written about your WikiLeaks in Latin America, the last one by two Argentinian authors featuring a country-by-country analysis. And in the case of Ecuador, it shows how, in a shameless way, the media did not publish those cables or news which affected them. For instance, disputes amongst information and news groups. In the end, to avoid being discredited, they reach an agreement not to air their dirty linen in public. I will read you one of the WikiLeaks documents the Ecuadorian press never published. The fact that the press feels free to criticize the government and yet it is unable to do so with a fugitive banker and his family businesses speaks volumes about where power resides in Ecuador. These are the messages made public by WikiLeaks, yet unpublished by the Ecuadorian press. This is just for you to see what we face in Ecuador and Latin America. We believe, my dear Julian, that the only things that should be protected against information sharing and freedom of speech are those set in the international treaties, in the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights, the honor and the reputation of people and the safety of people and the state. The rest, the more people find out about it, the better. You have voiced your fear, recurrent in journalists of good faith, But these are stereotypical fears that the state may restrict freedom of speech. This is hardly ever seen in Latin America. These are just myths. Please, bear in mind that here the media power was, and it probably is, greater than the political power. In fact, it usually has self-serving political, economic, social power, and above all, informative power. And it is the big voters, the powerful legislators, the mighty judges that have set the media agenda. This way, they have subdued governments, presidents, and courts. Let's stop portraying this image of poor and courageous journalists, saint-like media trying to tell the truth, and tyrants, autocrats, and dictators trying to hinder that. It isn't true. It's the other way round. The governments, trying to do something for the majority of the people, are persecuted by journalists who think that by having a pen and a microphone, they can direct even their resentment against you. They often insult and slander out of sheer dislike. These are mass media serving someone's private interests. Please, let the world know about what happens in Latin America. When I took office, there were 7 national TV channels. There wasn't state-owned television. They were all private, and 5 of them belonged to bankers. As you can imagine, if I wanted to take measures against banking in order to prevent, for instance, the crisis and the abuses which are now taking place in Europe, especially in Spain, I had to face a merciless TV campaign aimed at defending their owners' interests, the owners of these TV networks who were the bankers. Let's not fool ourselves. Let's get rid of these false stereotypes depicting wicked governments persecuting saint-like and courageous journalists and news outlets. Often, Julian, it's the other way around. These people, disguised as journalists, are trying to do politics, to destabilize our governments so that no change takes place in our region for fear of losing the power they have always flaunted about.
President Correa, I agree with your market description of the media. We have seen this again and again, that big media organizations that we have worked with, like The Guardian, El País, New York Times, and Der Spiegel, have censored our material against our agreements when they published it for political reasons or to protect oligarchs like Timoshenko from the Ukraine, who was hiding her wealth in London, or big corrupt Italian oil companies operating in Kazakhstan. We have proof of this because we know what the original document contains, and we can see what they printed, and we can see what they have removed. But it seems to me that the correct approach to deal with monopolies and duopolies and cartels in a market is to break them up or to make it so it is very easy for new publishers to enter in to the market. Shouldn't you create a system that protects the ease of entry into the publishing market so that small publishers and individuals are protected and have no regulation, and that these bigger publishers are broken up or are regulated?
That is what we are trying to do, Julian. For over 2 years, we've had this debate about a new communications law aimed at segmenting the radio and television industry. We only want a third of all radio and television broadcasters to be private and profit-making. Another third should be non-profit and belong to the community. And the remaining third should be state-owned, not run just by central government, but also by local authorities, municipalities, and parochial bodies. The process has taken 2 years, and all this despite the fact that this order is part of the Constitution approved by voting in 2008, despite the fact that the order was upheld by the Ecuadorian people during last year's referendum. Nevertheless, this new law has been systematically blocked by the big media outlets, the paid legislators they have in the National Assembly who defend their interests. Refer to it as the gag law, while the only thing we are trying to do is to make information and social communication and ownership of the media more democratic. But clearly, we face bitter opposition on the part of the media owners and their lobbyists in the Ecuadorian political arena.
And that, Julian Assange speaking with President Correa of Ecuador. Julian Assange has requested asylum because of the British order that he be extradited to Sweden. There are concerns that he might be rendered from there to the United States. At this point in time, he remains inside the Ecuador embassy, and it is unknown when there will be another production of the Julian Assange show called The World Tomorrow, depending perhaps on whether they have Wi-Fi inside the embassy. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, with production by Thiago Barroso and engineering by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments and suggestions and questions and leaks with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.